The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine this week, dated September 21st, 2012. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section of the Week magazine. Our headline article for this week is Chicago's Battle Over Evaluating Teachers. What happened? In a labor battle with nationwide implications, Chicago's teachers went on strike this past week over a new teacher evaluation system proposed by Democratic Mayor Rahm Emanuel, leaving 400,000 students at home or on the streets. About 26,000 educators in the nation's third largest school system walked out over Emanuel's proposed changes to teacher evaluation procedures, which would emphasize standardized test scores in assessing teachers' performance. The Chicago Teachers Union says it's unfair to judge teachers so heavily on their pupils' scores, contending that student performance can be influenced by poverty, neglect, and other factors teachers don't control. The same debate over high-stakes testing and teacher evaluation has played out in school districts across the country, so the Chicago strike was being closely watched as a possible watershed event. The teachers union is also seeking a pay raise of up to 29% to compensate for the lengthening of the Chicago school day from 5 hours and 45 minutes to 7 hours. With the city in dire financial trouble, Emanuel offered teachers a 16% pay increase over the next 4 years. He insisted that the new evaluation system and longer school day would benefit students and blamed teachers for calling a strike by choice while the two sides negotiated. Our kids do not deserve this, he said. Now here's what the editorial said. Just when you thought organized labor couldn't get any more ignorant or arrogant, said the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, along come Chicago's teachers demanding a pay raise from a school district facing a $1 billion deficit by year's end. Their $76,000 average salary already makes them the highest paid public teachers in the land. If this strike has an upside, said the Wall Street Journal, it's that it might force Democrats to realize that the party's pact with labor unions, you fund us and we'll agree to your every demand, threatens taxpayers and is immoral to boot. Let's hope Emanuel stands up to the teachers' blackmail. The major issue here isn't pay, said CSMonitor.com. Instead, this strike marks a major pushback against a national movement for teacher accountability. Evaluating teachers on their students' performance is at the heart of President Obama's education reform strategy. So much is at stake in this strike, and not just for Chicago. Now here's what the columnist said. Despite what the bullying Emanuel says, teachers aren't greedy thugs, said Sally Cohn in Salon.com. They're fighting for their students to get a quality education with better teaching materials, smaller classes, and air-conditioned in dilapidated aging schools. Emanuel would rather funnel public money into charter schools while further undermining underfunded public schools in poor neighborhoods. About 80% of Chicago students are poor, said Rebecca Mead in NewYorker.com. They come from neighborhoods filled with violence and chaos and from homes without parental support or space to study. Blaming teacher for these kids' failures is like blaming doctors for the diseases they are seeking to treat. Emmanuel is right to stand up to the union's irrational pay demand, said Frederick Hess and Michael McShane in NationalReview.com. And it's clear that Chicago's existing accountability system needs to be changed. It now rates 99% of its teachers as effective, yet 40% of the students drop out before graduating from high school. But progressives like Emmanuel and Obama fall into a trap when they believe problem schools can be fixed through a new bureaucratic dictate, such as a one-size-fits-all evaluation system based on test scores. There's no real evidence that such reforms are working, said Joe Nocera in the New York Times. High-stakes testing and charter schools, which were supposed to introduce choice and competition and force big city schools to improve, have produced very mixed results. And while teachers' unions and reformers battle it out across the U.S., our kids continue to fall behind. American students now rank behind most of Asia and much of Europe in math, science, and literacy. That crisis won't be solved until we completely rethink the way we offer public education, coming up with reforms that actually work. What Chicago's bitter struggles illustrates is how far we are from that goal. Our next item from the main story section today is U.S. diplomats killed in Libya. The U.S. ambassador to Libya and three other Americans were killed this past week when Islamist militants stormed the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, acting out the Muslim world's growing anger over an obscure anti-Muslim video. U.S. officials said that Ambassador Christopher Stevens, 52 years old, died after a rocket-propelled grenade set the consulate ablaze. President Obama condemned the outrageous attack and vowed that justice will be done. The killings came just hours after a mob in neighboring Egypt scaled the walls of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo in rage over the YouTube trailer for the amateurish film The Innocence of Muslims, which portrays the Prophet Muhammad as a womanizing, child-abusing thug. The purported filmmaker, a man who calls himself Sam Basile and claims to be a California-based Israeli Jew, said he was sorry about the deaths, but still believed in the film's message. Islam is a cancer, he said. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney quickly accused Obama of sympathizing with those who waged the attacks, a reference to a statement by the embassy in Cairo that criticized misguided individuals for offending Muslims. The White House condemned Romney for using Stevens' death to launch a political attack, noting that the embassy's statement preceded the violence. Romney's response to this tragedy was shameful, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com, but hardly surprising. This is the kind of nonsense you get when one party spends 4 years convincing itself that a president is something he isn't. Obama really does bear some responsibility for this bloodshed, said Peter Kirsanoff in NationalReview.com. He opted to back Libya's rebels in their struggle against Muammar al-Qaddafi, ignoring evidence that al-Qaeda forces were among them. Those militants undoubtedly were involved in this latest outrage. Sadly, Obama's naive Middle East policy has yielded only contempt and aggression. Abandoning the Arab Spring would bring far worse results, said Shadi Hamid in foreignpolicy.com. If we give up on the fledgling democracies in Libya, Egypt, and Tunisia, Islamist extremists will fill the vacuum. Now more than ever, Americans need to hear a clear narrative of why Arab Democrats need our support. Obama should adopt the Bush administration mantra, "Don't let the terrorists win." It's simplistic, but today, it actually makes sense. In a related item, the next article is entitled Sunni Rage in Iraq. Iraq's deepening political crisis sparked a new wave of violence this past week after one of the country's most senior Sunni politicians, Vice President Tariq al-Hashemi, was sentenced to death in absentia on what he called politically motivated terror charges. Al-Hashemi, who fled to Turkey earlier this year, was found guilty of overseeing death squads that targeted Shiite political opponents. Al-Hashemi said that the charges were concocted by his rival, Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, and that the kangaroo court's verdict was predetermined. Underscoring Iraq's continued instability, a wave of bombings and insurgent attacks tore through mostly Shiite neighborhoods in more than a dozen cities the day the verdict was announced, killing at least 100 people. It is hard to weigh the merits of this politically charged case from a distance, said the New York Times in an editorial, but al-Maliki's blatant attempts to monopolize power are reason enough to be suspicious. Since U.S. troops departed in December, the prime minister has shown more interest in reprisals against the Sunni minority than in binding the war-ravaged country altogether. Al-Maliki is on a clear path to becoming Iraq's next dictator, said The Guardian in the UK. He has ruthlessly consolidated control of the country's security forces for his own ends and exerted increasing influence over the intelligence services and judiciary. Having sidelined Sunnis, his next target will be the Kurds. Al-Maliki's quest for domination could drive his country back into civil war. Equally troubling are al-Maliki's deepening ties to the Shiite regime in Iran, said Tony Karen in Time.com. In July, Iraq granted Iran use of its airspace to resupply President Bashar al-Assad's forces in Syria, despite the angry objections of the White House. It's surely one of the greatest strategic ironies of the 21st century that the Iraq War, which cost the U.S. so dearly in blood and treasure, ended up producing an Iraqi regime closer to Iran than it is to the U.S. And now we'll turn from the main stories to the controversy of the week, Obamacare. What is Romney's alternative? I'm trying to figure out just where Mitt Romney stands on health care reform, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, and evidently so is Mitt Romney. This week, the man who promised conservatives he'd repeal President Obama's Affordable Care Act caused an uproar by telling the NBC Meet the Press program that there are a number of things I like in health care reform, including the act's requirement that insurers offer coverage to those with pre-existing conditions. Conservatives erupted in outrage, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, and the Romney camp rushed out a series of its now familiar clarifications, first that Romney believed the free market would solve the pre-existing condition problem, then another hours later saying that a President Romney would ban discrimination against individuals with pre-existing conditions who maintain continuous coverage. Even for the Etch-a-Sketch candidate, three different positions on an issue in a single day is a record. Poppycock, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Romney's position on health care has been consistent all along. He will repeal Obamacare in its entirety. He will ensure that those with pre-existing conditions don't lose their insurance if they change jobs or switch between plans. And for those with pre-existing conditions who don't already have insurance, Romney proposes setting up high-risk pools that would be required to accept all applicants. Romney's plan, in other words, is the same as just about every conservative health care proposal in recent years, said Yuval Levin in NationalReview.com, including John McCain's in 2008. But the liberal media now thinks Obamacare is the definition of health care reform, so it reflexively assumes that any other plan would be a step backward. In reality, it's entirely possible to extend insurance coverage to people who are excluded because of pre-existing conditions without Obama's monstrously complex $2 trillion disaster. The Affordable Care Act has flaws, said Carolyn McClanahan in Forbes.com, but Romney's alternative plan seems to be no plan at all. Federal law already requires insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions if they've maintained continuous coverage, but 89 million Americans don't qualify for that protection. Sending the sickest of them to high-risk pools would result in extremely high premiums that will truly be unaffordable for most of the population. As the author of Romney Care in Massachusetts, Romney knows all this, said Jonathan Chait and NYMag.com. He knows that without ACA's individual mandate, insurers simply couldn't afford to cover those with pre-existing conditions or to keep children on their parents' insurance until the age of 26, the ACA's other most popular provision. So Romney wants people to believe he'll keep all the popular parts of Obamacare and get rid of the unpopular parts. That's not a coherent policy. It's a campaign ploy. Come on now, said Grace Marie Turner in NationalReview.com. It would be politically foolish for Romney to scrap the ACA's most popular provisions. If elected, Romney will find a way to get health reform right without turning one-sixth of the economy over to the federal government. Now I understand, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. It's the same position Romney has taken on tax cuts, deficits, and entitlements. He's for whatever pleases both his conservative base and centrist swing voters. And if that sounds confusing, he'll explain later. The big problem with trying to strategically confuse people is that you actually do confuse them. Now we'll turn from the main story section in the Week magazine to the popular article, Good Week for and Bad Week for. It was a good week for company loyalty after 92-year-old Rose Syracuse of Brooklyn retired from her job at Macy's after 73 years, the longest-serving employee in the company's history. This was my first job, and I didn't go anyplace else, said Syracuse, who started with the store when FDR was president and credit cards did not yet exist. It was a good week for Leadfoots after the Texas Transportation Commission approved an 85-mile-per-hour speed limit for a stretch of road near Austin, topping the previous national record of 80 miles per hour for highways in southern Utah and western Texas. And it was a good week for the word literally, which Vice President Joe Biden used 9 times in his speech at the Democratic National Convention, including literally twice in one sentence. It was a bad week for Jay Leno after the host of NBC's The Tonight Show took a 50% pay cut as NBC cut the show's annual budget. Now he only makes $15 million a year. It was a bad week for Jeff Fleming of Reno, Nevada, who got so sick of people hitting his home next to a golf course with errant shots that he allegedly blasted one duffer with a shotgun, causing minor wounds. I'm not really sure what finally set him off, said Police Lieutenant Keith Brown. And it was a bad week for witches and seers after eBay banned the sale of metaphysical services such as magical potions and lottery number predictions. We want a trusted marketplace where buyers have a consistently great experience, said eBay official Devin Wenig, noting that potions, prophecies, and spells were not meeting that bar. Now we'll turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine for this week. Our briefing article this time around is entitled The War on Wildfires. Wildfires ravaged extensive areas of the country this summer. Is this the new normal? How many wildfires were there? More than 45,000, and they destroyed more acres of forest than in any year on record. An unusually mild winter that left little snowpack gave way to a hot, dry summer across much of the South and the Midwest, turning huge swaths of the country into a giant tinderbox. Almost 13,000 square miles of land in California, Utah, New Mexico, Colorado, and other states, an area larger than Massachusetts, have been burned by wildfires this year. And the fire season isn't over yet. Last year, 34 large fires were still burning. Over the past decade, there have been 6 unusually severe fire seasons, suggesting that extensive wildfires have become the new normal. Fire activity has definitely increased in terms of overall activity and acreage burns, said William Summers, former director of fire research for the U.S. Forest Service. Why are wildfires getting worse? Climate change is clearly a factor. The past decade has been hotter in the U.S. than any in recorded history, and prolonged drought has left forests highly combustible. The spread of human development into once remote fire-prone areas has not helped. 1 out of every 4 homes in Colorado, which suffered a brutal fire season this summer, has been built in a red zone of high wildfire risk. This kind of sprawl leads fire officials to quickly suppress any fire that threatens human lives or dwellings, which disrupts the natural fire cycle, setting the stage for larger and more intense fires. What is the natural fire cycle? Wooded areas naturally accumulate lots of dead wood, leaves, pine needles, and underbrush on the forest floor. For millennia, nature's way of clearing this undergrowth came in the form of smaller fires that would periodically roll across forests, thinning them and renewing the soil. Human habitation changes that pattern as people suppress all fires to protect lives and property. As a result, the underbrush and dead wood grow very dense and serve as a huge store of kindling when a fire is sparked. Such fires can burn intensely and race rapidly across the landscape, defying efforts to stop them. This year, the fire season was so bad, the U.S. Forest Service changed its firefighting strategy for the first time in decades. What was the new strategy? The Forest Service ordered all blazes to be snuffed out, no matter their size or location. In recent years, smaller blazes in remote areas had been allowed to burn to restore the natural fire cycle. But controlling these prescribed fires has become more difficult because of the drought. Prescribed fires are also expensive to carry out, and federal firefighting funding has been slashed by $512 million, or 15%, since 2010. So in the face of this year's extraordinary conditions, the agency decided that suppressing all fires quickly was its only option. Does that make sense? In the short term, perhaps, but total suppression is not only counterproductive, it's impossible. Thousands of fires still occur each month, sparked by everything from recklessly discarded cigarettes to lightning strikes. And budget cuts are making firefighting efforts even harder. The U.S. Forest Service employs about 10,000 firefighters to cover dozens of states and relies on local crews for help. State and local government budget cuts, however, have eaten into that support. In California, for example, the state cut 750 seasonal firefighters last year in order to shave $34 million off its budget. In recent years, the federal government has also failed to invest in new equipment such as the air tankers and drop thousands of gallons of water or fire retardant on wildfires. The Forest Service had 43 air tankers on call in 2000. But when some of these decades-old planes crashed, many of them were taken out of service, and there were just 9 available tankers earlier this year. President Obama finally signed a $24 million bill to fund 7 additional tankers, but many of those will not be operational for months. What does the future hold? The federal government is slowly moving toward a more preventive approach through a computerized system that would model fire-prone regions and predict the likelihood of fires and how quickly they might spread. This would alert fire officials to do some controlled burns and take other steps to stop wildfires from getting out of control. Simulating the fire behavior in a computer is really the future, said Mark Finney, a U.S. Forest Service researcher. But the technology has been very slow to emerge. The government originally said the prediction system would be operational by 2007, but ran into many programming problems and now says a scale-back version will be rolled out next year. That'll be too late, of course, for the thousands of people whose communities were destroyed in 2012 as wildfires reduced vast forests to smoldering ash. Billions of dollars, homes, and people's lives were at stake, said Chester Joy, a retired natural resources expert for the Government Accountability Office, and now we're paying the price. And now the footnote to today's briefing article, Punishing Arsonists and Fools. About 90% of wildfires are started by humans, experts estimate. And over the last decade, as wildfires have become more damaging, the penalties for setting them, either inadvertently or on purpose, have become more severe. Two arsonists in California now face the death penalty for setting wildfires that resulted in the loss of human life. Texas, meanwhile, recently increased the maximum penalty for arson to life in prison. States are also ratcheting up the punishments on people who start wildfires through negligence. Utah now has a law requiring those responsible for starting a fire to pay back the costs of fighting it, which typically run into millions of dollars. Some reckless fire starters are even sent to jail. William Rupp of Jones Valley, California, was jailed for 4 years in 2006 for negligent use of a lawnmower after the blade of his ride-on mower struck a rock. The resulting sparks ignited drought-stricken grass, sparking a major wildfire that destroyed 80 homes. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine this week on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled The Shocking Negligence Before 9/11 by Kurt Eichenwald in the New York Times. In the months before 9/11, Kurt Eichenwald said, George W. Bush was warned not once but multiple times that al-Qaeda was preparing a major attack on U.S. soil. Everyone knows of the August 6, 2001 intelligence briefing that Bush received at his Texas ranch, headed Bin Laden Determined to Strike U.S. Administration officials later dismissed that warning's significance, insisting, implausibly, that it was too vague to warrant a response. But in researching a new book, I've read several still classified documents that show a panicky CIA repeatedly trying to alert Bush to the al-Qaeda threat. On May 1st, the CIA told the president that a group presently in the U.S. was plotting a major terrorist attack. On June 22nd, Bush was told the attack could be imminent. Administration neocons viewed Saddam Hussein as a much greater threat than Osama bin Laden, so Bush shrugged it all off. But on June 29th, the CIA stated in Bush's daily brief that the al-Qaeda plot was real and would have dramatic consequences. We'll never know if Bush could have stopped 9/11, but there can be no doubt that he was guilty of a shocking level of negligence. The next column is entitled Bombing Iran Won't Be a Cakewalk by Noah Schachtman in Wired.com. What would the U.S. need to do to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities, asked Noah Schachtman. A new analysis has found that it would require an all-out effort involving squadrons of bombers and fighter jets, interceptor missiles, drones, Navy carrier strike groups, in other words, a war. The analysis by defense expert Anthony Cordesman says the mission would begin with at least 90 fighter jets launching simultaneous attacks on the country's extensive air defense network and numerous missile sites. B-2 stealth bombers would then drop 30,000-pound bunker-busting bombs on Iran's nuclear sites, excuse me, some of which are buried beneath mountains. After that first strike, U.S. warships and minesweepers would fight for months to stop Iran from blocking the Strait of Hormuz and cutting off 20% of the world's oil supply. Despite our best efforts, Cordesman warns, Iran's retaliation against Israel and U.S. allies in the Gulf would be fierce, with devastating regional consequences. Hawks may still feel that attacking Iran is the best option, but there is a reason military planners are so wary. The next column is When Facts Are Matters of Opinions by Gordon Kravitz in the Wall Street Journal. What is a fact checker? It's a journalist who claims to be an impartial arbiter of political campaigns while wielding the same old biases, said Gordon Kravitz. This political season has seen a proliferation of fact checkers who analyze political ads and claims by candidates and decide whether they're wholly true, partially true, or pants on fire lies. But in practice, many policy disagreements and political arguments cannot be separated into simple categories of true or outright falsehood. And, not surprisingly, the media's interpretations have been much kinder to the Democrats. Take the Romney campaign's claim that the White House had relaxed the work requirements for welfare. The fact-checkers call this a lie, accepting Obama's claim that he simply wanted to give states more flexibility to set their own work requirements. But some experts say the new rules could easily lead to the watering down of those requirements. In short, this is a policy debate, not a question of fact. Today, anyone can research and check politicians' claims themselves online. It's time for the media to stop pretending it has a monopoly on the truth. Now I'm going to read to you from the Health and Science section of the Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, DNA Switches, A New Insight into Genes. When scientists first began decoding the human genome in the late 1990s, they were surprised to discover that 98% of the DNA was junk with no apparent purpose. It turns out that they were wrong. New research by an international team of 440 scientists has discovered that most junk DNA actually serves as switches that turn genes on or off, a finding that could lead to entirely new ways of preventing and treating disease. The presence of DNA switches in every person's genetic makeup, researchers say, explains why some people who are predisposed to certain diseases get them, while others don't. A person who inherits a vulnerability to breast cancer, for example, might never develop the disease unless some environmental factor or experience switches the bad gene on. The whole way that we look at the genetic basis of disease is going to change, according to researcher John Stamatoianopoulos. And that's what he told NPR.org. The human genome contains at least 4 million of these switches, and scientists are already linking specific ones to multiple sclerosis, asthma, type 1 diabetes, cancer, and mental illness. Figuring out exactly what each switch does could lead to new drug treatments and will revolutionize medicine. Says lead researcher Ewan Burney, it's going to take this century to fill in all the details. The next article from the Health and Science section is Organic Food Better. Americans now pay quite a bit extra to buy organic foods, but is it worth it? That depends on what benefits they expect. A new Stanford University review of 237 studies found that organic produce does have less pesticide residue, but it did not find strong evidence that organic foods are more nutritious, study author Crystal Smith Spangler tells Time.com. The researchers said they expected to find higher levels of vitamins and minerals in organic produce, but did not. Organic produce also wasn't completely free of pesticide residue, probably because it is sometimes grown close to non-organic fields. On average, 7% of organic produce contained pesticides, compared with 38% of non-organic produce, though at all levels, the Food and Drug Administration generally considers them safe. Organic meat and poultry, which must be raised without antibiotics or growth hormones, also contain fewer antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Many advocates say that buying organic is still worth it, if only to avoid long-term exposure to pesticides and hormones, especially for children. Recent studies have found that children exposed to pesticides have a higher risk of attention deficits and lower IQ. The next article, to eat less, slow down. Want to eat less? Dim the lights, play some soft music, and put some candles and flowers on the dinner table. That's what researchers from Cornell University did at a Hardee's fast food restaurant to test how environment affects our eating habits. The scientists revamped the usually garish and loud dining area to review window shades, tablecloths, candlelights, plants, and soft jazz, and found that patrons who ate there left 18% more food on their plates, about 175 calories worth, than patrons who dined in the traditional Hardee's setting, even though both groups ordered the same amount of food. The explanation is simple. Study author Brian Wasnick tells Reuters.com, people responded to the calmer, more relaxed setting by eating 5% slower. As they chatted more and chewed at a more leisurely pace, these patrons also reported feeling more satisfied and happier than those who wolfed down more food more quickly. The next item, your most empathetic friend. Dogs really may be man's best friend, ranking even higher than our fellow humans in empathy. British researchers put pet dogs of different ages and breeds in a room with their owners or a stranger. Then they had the people either hum, talk, or pretend to cry. They found that the dogs responded most strongly to people who cried, submissively nuzzling and licking the crier, the canine version of offering comfort, whether they knew the person or not. Dogs did not respond to the humming, even though researchers thought that the unusual sound might be likely to pique the dog's curiosity, study author Deborah Custance of the University of London tells DailyMail.com. She says the dog's behavior shows how highly attuned they are to human emotions, owing to thousands of years of evolution. The better a dog responds to human emotion, and the more likely we are to give the animal food and shelter, and ensure that the pet's genes are passed on to the next generation. We have selectively bred them to act as our companions, Custon says. And the next article, and our final one in the health and science section, is the health scare of the week, a new tick-borne illness. A mysterious tick-borne virus, previously unknown to researchers, has emerged in Missouri. The new heartland virus caused two farmers to fall seriously ill with high fevers, muscle pain, diarrhea, and liver problems. The men were hospitalized with what doctors suspected was a common tick-borne bacteria. But when they failed to respond to antibiotics, scientists at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tested their blood and discovered a never-before-seen virus. The bug is closely related to the SFTS virus, which recently discovered in China, which has proved fatal in 12% of cases. So far, the heartland virus is known to have infected only two people, both of whom recovered. But Scott Folk, an infectious disease expert who treated the farmers, tells the NBCNews.com that since most doctors don't know the virus exists, it could be responsible for more illness than we think. Wearing insect repellent and long pants and sleeves in wooded areas where ticks live is the only way to protect against the heartland virus, as well as other potentially deadly tick-borne illnesses such as Lyme disease, babesiosis, and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Now we will flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week to the article entitled The Last Word. And this particular subject this week is entitled Message from the South Tower. On September 11th, 2001, Randy Scott scrawled a desperate note, says John Brunick. It took 10 years to find his family. The message contained just five words and two numbers that Randy Scott, a husband and father of three, wrote on a piece of paper on September 11, 2001. It floated down from his office at Eurobrokers, Inc. on an upper floor of Two World Trade Center to the chaotic streets below and was tenderly preserved as it traveled from hand to hand over the course of a decade. 84th floor, West Office. 12 people trapped. Denise Scott learned of her husband's last message in August 2011, just weeks before the 10th anniversary of his death and the World Trade Center's collapse. For those 10 years, his family members believed he had died instantly when United Airlines Flight 175 flew into the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. near the floors containing Eurobrokers' offices. The note, as his family refers to it, changed everything. The voices of Denise and her children overlap as they consider how the note changed their oral history of Randy's final moments. Each delivers a piece of the agonizing account as though trying to spare the others. I spent 10 years hoping that Randy wasn't trapped in that building, said Denise, 57, at her Stamford, Connecticut home, with two of her three daughters, Rebecca, 29, and Alexandria, 22, at her side. I thought he was killed instantly, Rebecca interjected. It was so close to impact, Alexandria said. Randy Scott's daughters fought tears as his message again triggered new mental images. In a steady tone, their mother explained the power of the note. You don't want them to suffer. They're trapped in a burning building. It's just an unspeakable horror. And then you get this 10 years later. It just changes everything. It is not the words alone that change the narrative of Randy Scott's final moments. On the note is a dark spot about the size of a thumbprint. It is Randy's blood, which provided the clue that eventually enabled the medical examiner's office to trace the source of the note through DNA tests and deliver it to his family a decade after he apparently tossed it from the 84th floor. After the first plane hit One World Trade Center, Randy, 48, called Denise at Springdale School. She was in class with her first grade students, so someone picked up the school line and passed along the message. Thinking the first crash was a minor incident, she just wanted to know he was fine. The full news of the terrorist attacks would not reach Denise until later that morning when Rebecca called her from Ohio, where she was attending college. For the next few days, they considered Randy a missing person, checking bars, restaurants, and hospitals. In the years to follow, Denise recorded key information in a black notebook. 4 days before another September 11th anniversary, she consulted the notebook to ensure she was accurate in sharing details. She refers to the space in the front of the house as the 9/11 room, since it is here that so many friends and family members gathered nearly 11 years ago, waiting for news and consoling one another. Though Denise quickly dismissed her own name for the room, it is accented by reminders of one of the most famous days in U.S. history, the New York Times book Portraits 9/11/01 on the coffee table. The faint names of the victims woven into an American flag on the wall over the piano, photos of Randy with family members and at play. The house, which they moved into 2 decades ago, is blue with white trim. Red shutters were added to complete the color scheme weeks before September 11, 2001. Now they make an indelible reference point. We're the red, white, and blue house, Rebecca says wryly when offering directions. After returning from a day with her second grade class at Springdale, Denise tells the story of the note like a school teacher. She avoids dramatic embellishments. I try not to personalize it, just the facts, and references her black notebook when needed. Her account is punctuated by flashes of emotion. She pauses to ensure accuracy and laughs when describing her husband. Denise was out of town visiting a friend in August 2011 when she received a call from the office of the Chief Medical Examiner of New York. With the passage of time and the evolution of DNA technology, the office will sometimes call families with news that something has been identified, most often fragments of remains. This call, though, came from Dr. Barbara Butcher, Chief of Staff and Director of Forensic Investigations at the Medical Examiner's Office. I said, "What kind of fragment?" Denise recalled. She said, "No, it's not a fragment. It's something written." And that's when I just fell apart. Denise did not know the contents of the note or how it had been linked to Randy. The uncertainty made her grateful that she was able to process the news alone, away from her daughters, for fear of upsetting them. "I was a mess," she said, "because I didn't know what it was." She slowed her cadence for emphasis. It was 10 years later. It was the 10th anniversary, and they started replaying everything. It was hard enough anyway, and to get a phone call 10 years later, it's not even to learn there are more remains, more fragments. They call them fragments. It's 10 years, and now it's something else again, and it's something I had no idea existed. Her sole confidant was Steve Ernst, Randy's best friend. When they went to New York to see the note, she took a substitute for her traditional notebook. "She leaves the house with this black book. We know something's up," Rebecca said. Denise also brought a sample of Randy's handwriting, thinking she would need it for identification. "The minute I saw it, I didn't need to see the DNA test," she said. "I saw the handwriting. It's Randy's handwriting." Butcher retraced the note's path through the years. Someone on the street found it immediately and handed it to a guard at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Just then, the world changed. "The building was gone," Denise said. The Federal Reserve kept the note safe, eventually turning it over to the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. The museum worked with the Medical Examiner's Office, which traced it to Randy in the summer of 2011. "I'm speechless that they actually were able to identify it," Denise said. "This note was written on September 11th. It came out of a window. Somebody had it. People had their hands all over it." Butcher posed a question for her to consider. The museum wanted to exhibit the letter with Denise's permission. She agreed, asking only that they embargo it until she told her daughters. Jan Ramirez, chief curator of the museum, said the note is exceptionally rare. "I don't know of anything else like it. There have been other pieces of paper that came out of the towers that day to which we have been able to attach some powerful stories, but none have been quite as rare and unusual and inspiring and sad and touching as this particular one. It really is in a class by itself," she said. Denise's decision on the exhibit came easily. Choosing the right time to share the news with her daughters became a tortured process. The 10th anniversary passed. Alexandra had started her fall semester. Holidays came and went. In January, Denise's father died. She decided the time was right to bring her three daughters, Rebecca, Alexandra, and Jessica, into the family room and share the news. "I was bawling because I recognized his handwriting," Rebecca recalled. They knew it had changed not just their father's narrative, but that of the 11 other people referenced in the note. "Everyone hoped that it was right on impact, that he didn't suffer," Alexandra said. "Not only to know that he was trapped, but what he was going through. And we knew the guys in his office, too, and they had kids and they had families, and to think that they were terrified." Rebecca, Alexandra, and Jessica dismissed their mother's anxiety about her decision to delay delivering the news. The Scotts also knew that they had to widen the circle, reaching out to other relatives and to the families of Randy's co-workers. The five words and two numbers had written a new narrative for them as well, a narrative Denise found herself repeating in the months to come, again and again and again and again and again. In March, Denise and Rebecca took a hard hat tour of the 9/11 Memorial Museum, which is not yet open to the public. They were shown the area where Randy's note will be displayed as part of an exhibit to document the final moments inside the World Trade Center. It's so amazing to think that Randy Scott wrote it and eventually ended up with his wife and three daughters, said Ramirez, the museum's curator. We are incredibly proud to be able to show it, and I think it will be one of the most powerful artifacts in the museum. The Scotts are aware that if not for the spot of Randy's blood, they and other families could have one day seen the letter in the museum without knowing its origins. Over the past 11 years, some families have chosen not to be notified by the medical examiner's office when fragments are found. I can't do that. I can't do that, Denise said. The last notification of remains I got was in 2008, and I can't do that. I can't leave him there. I cannot leave him there. Better to know the truth, even when it comes in the form of a message that took a decade to be delivered. It tells people the story of the day, Denise said, in just 5 words and 2 numbers. And that was copyrighted in 2012 by the Stamford, Connecticut Advocate, a Hearst, Connecticut Media Group company. All rights were reserved. And now, as we reach the end of our program today, we'll take a look at a few articles from the Talking Points section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, The Poor, Too Dependent on Handouts? We heard a lot of tributes to the middle class at last week's Democratic convention, said David Crary in the Associated Press, and many references to the rich, albeit as a punching bag. But for a party long known as the defender of the downtrodden, the lack of attention paid by Democrats to America's poor was striking. It was striking but not surprising, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com. Under President Obama, the nation's food stamp rolls have swelled by 18 million to 46.7 million, with half of all children now relying on food aid at some point. In the Obama economy, the poor have become more dependent than ever before on government handouts such as food stamps, unemployment benefits, and Medicaid. People who depend on government tend to vote Democratic, which is why Democrats are keen to keep them that way. Are the causes of poverty really that simple? Asked Michael Crowley in Time.com. Unfortunately, with the middle class reeling, there's widespread resentment against people who receive any kind of government aid. But as Bill Clinton pointed out at the convention, safety net programs are not just for them. About 40% of Medicaid spending, for example, goes to provide nursing home care for seniors who've exhausted their assets, many of them formerly middle class. So if we take an axe to Medicaid, as Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan proposed, do we throw these old people out on the street? It's easy to cloak heartlessness in phrases like culture of dependency, said Michael Hiltrix in the Los Angeles Times, but make no mistake, if Medicaid is cut heavily, struggling hospitals and nursing homes will close, and millions of seniors, children, and the disabled will suffer. When I hear people complain about takers, said Colbert King in the Washington Post, I think of the old woman I recently saw in a supermarket checkout line. She watched anxiously as the cashier rang up her meager purchases, then handed 2 cans of soup back to him. She didn't have enough money. I also think of the working poor I see each morning at the bus stop, their faces drawn with fatigue as they head off to another long day of serving people who have more money. Sure, we cut off food stamps and health care to these faceless people, but do we really want a winner-take-all society? The next article, Obama's bounce has the race shifted. All elections have turning points, said Nate Silver in NYTimes.com. And last week's Democratic National Convention may have been exactly that. President Obama received a big post-convention bounce in the polls this past week, with a Gallup survey giving him a 6-point lead over Republican challenger Mitt Romney, and even the right-leaning Rasmussen polls giving him a 3-point lead. In a tight race where very little has moved, the polls polls much all this year, the president now seems to be the clear front runner. It's too soon to know if the bounce will last, said Nate Cohn in TNR.com, but it's already clear that Romney's chances are in jeopardy. The Republican nominee received no detectable bounce from his own party's convention or from his selection of Paul Ryan as a running mate. Moreover, he has never led President Obama in the RealClearPolitics.com average, which collates data from multiple polls. That historically accurate aggregated poll now shows Obama ahead 49 to 45.4%. With most of the electorate already committed, there isn't much likelihood of a Republican come-from-behind Reagan-esque sweep of undecided voters. That's nonsense, said Con Carroll in Washington Examiner. Obama's bounce will be temporary, just as every prior president's post-convention bump has been. It's a sugar high, as Romney pollster Neil Newhouse put it. The president's approval rating already dropped from 52% at the end of the convention to 50% a few days later, after the latest disappointing jobs report. Don't let anybody fool you. This is a close election. What's more, that bounce had little to do with Obama, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, and everything to do with Bill Clinton, who dramatically overshadowed the president at last week's convention with his usual rousing rhetoric. Only 43% of voters rated Obama's speech as excellent or good, according to Gallup, compared with 56% who said the same about Clinton. This was a Clinton bump. Unfortunately for Obama, his name will appear on the November ballot. All Clinton did was persuasively lay out Obama's argument for re-election, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com, and that's what has caused the shift in polling. Most Americans weren't paying much attention to the presidential race until the conventions, essentially backing their party in reserve for before truly focusing. Now they have grasped the pragmatic, positive nature of Obama's message and the truly radical nature of the GOP platform on tax cuts for the rich, safety net shredding, and abortion. It cannot be encouraging for the Republicans that after the first real apples-to-apples focus on the choice, Obama has surged. Indeed, the Romney campaign appears to be panicked, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. This week it unleashed a massive swing state ad blitz in Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Ohio, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, and Virginia. But the campaign has apparently given up trying to win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, meaning Romney will need to nearly run the table of the other eight swing states to get to 270 electoral college votes. Just losing Ohio, a state where he currently polls 2 points behind Obama, would mean almost certain defeat. And now a couple of quick items before we close today. America spent $2.6 trillion on health care last year, but a third of that spending, $750 billion, was squandered on unnecessary treatments and tests, Byzantine paperwork, fraud, and other inefficiencies, according to the new analysis by the Institute of Medicine. And about 25% of seniors receiving Medicare spend all their savings and must sell their homes and other assets to pay for non-covered medical care in the last 5 years of life. According to a new study, nursing care accounts for much of that cost. Our poll watch, 52% of registered voters say they'd rather have President Obama at their homes for dinner than Mitt Romney. 33% say they'd prefer dinner with Romney. Asked which candidate they'd rather have as captain of a ship in a storm, 46% chose Obama and 43% chose Romney. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.